One, and we're live.
Welcome to the Church of Mavis radio show. It's Friday night. We're getting started a little late. There's some weird echo that wouldn't go away. It's about to make me crawl out of my skin. But luckily, it's gone now. Hal talks fast enough. It's like everything is just going nuts. So we're just going to blame Mercury retrograde like everything else. And thanks, Trumple Gooch. New Nation United Public Radio 107.7. That's it, New Orleans. For quality kratom at a fraction of the price of stores, go to TauntonBaySubcompany.com. Life is good, but life is better on Taunton Bay. That's TauntonBaySubcompany.com. Or call 207-422-2895 to speak to anyone for more information. UFO Congress, February 14th through the 18th, 2018, ufocongress.com. That's the 14th through the 18th, 2018. April 13th through the 15th, 2018, is the Ozark UFO Conference. You can go to ozarkufo.com. It's going to be at the Best Western end of the Ozarks Convention Center in Eureka Springs. A couple of books to plug, and then we'll get started. Both of these books are from St. Martin's Press. One's called Glass Town by Stephen Seville. Christopher Golden, a blurb from Christopher Golden on it. Graham Masterson, all kinds of blurbs. Jonathan Mayberry, Glass Town is a mind-bending, devious, and thoroughly entertaining thriller. Let me see here. One more book here, and we'll be done. One of Us Will Be Dead by Morning by David Moody. Just a blurb on the back. Guillermo del Toro, a blurb. That's a good blurb. A head-spinning thrill ride, a cautionary tale about the most salient emotion of the 21st century. Hater will haunt you long after you read the first page. All right, we got Jay here with us tonight. And,
good evening. How's it going, Jeff?
Miserable. It's raining here and cold in Florida. It's like thunderous winter. I think nuclear Ragnarok's coming.
Yeah, we're supposed to get snow tonight and early tomorrow, a couple, 3 inches maybe.
It's going to be what, like 20 there? How cold is it going to be there?
It was 33 most of the day, so just a tick above freezing.
It's going to be 30 here for Florida. That's cold for Florida. It's getting 30 degrees in Florida. That's cold.
Well, you can go outside to the trees and pick frozen concentrated orange juice right off the trees, and then.
The biggest thing with me, I have some weird connection with the sun. Like, I think I'm an Egyptian solar god or something. So when there's no sun, I feel like Nosferatu. Like, I'm like, man, I feel evil today. I'm just going to watch some shows and chill out. I feel like Nosferatu or what's the dude? Count Orlok.
Yeah. Hey, you're not the only one. I feel it too.
but let's get to our guest, Rich Newman, author of Ghost of the Civil War, exploring the paranormal history of America's deadliest war. Read some blurbs on it because, you know, I got a blurb on this book. Let's read the first blurb on it. Rich Newman's compelling new book is the best way to visit over 160 spine-tingling haunts in the most tragic of American conflicts by Jim Harrell, host of Paranormal Podcast and author of True Ghost Story. Now here's my blurb, a haunting historic adventure well worth the read. Jeffrey Pritchett, founder of the Church of Mavis Radio. That's like my, I did blurbs for my other co-host Wham's book, but she's like, self-published, so this is like my first blurb with a big, a little one. That's a pretty big score. That's a big blurb score. So now I'm supposed to be doing Richard Estep's blurb too for the little one. So now I'm a master blurber. And now for some reason I have some weird ringing in my right ear. So good to have you here, Rich, as we fall apart. How you doing?
Good, man. How you guys doing?
Not very good, but we're glad to be doing the show. I love this topic. I love the Civil War stuff, so Ghost of the Civil War. Doesn't get any better than that. I'm in Marianna, Florida, which is a big Civil War situation. I guess the Battle of Marianna, it's a whole historic to-do here about the Civil War. So what made you decide to conquer the Civil War this time around?
Well, I mean, when it kind of came up, you know, to do another book, this is my fifth with Llewellyn. She just, my publisher, Amy, just kind of threw it up, you know, what do you think you want to do? And I had done a documentary about 10 years ago called Ghosts of War that was about haunted Civil War places. And so I had really enjoyed making that documentary. And I thought, man, it'd be kind of cool to, you know, go back to that subject, hit some of those big battlefields. But even more, you know, more fun for me is hitting a lot of the antebellum homes, you know, that have the good ghost stories and everything about them. And we're chock full of those places around Memphis. So I thought it would be a great subject. She liked it, and here we are.
Well, I'm glad you did it. Where can you get that documentary out of yours? Is that for sale, or where did you do that at?
Well, it was actually my first project out of school, and we sold it to Sci-Fi, but they never actually aired it, to my knowledge. And then when the rights kind of came back to me, we ended up chopping it up into a mini-series, and you can actually watch 3 or 4 of the episodes on Vimeo. If you actually go to Vimeo and put in Ghosts of War, it'll come up. I think there's either maybe 3, 4 episodes on there right now.
Awesome. I'll have to make a note of that for sure and check it out. Ghosts of War. Put that in your notes. So, when it comes to Civil War battlefields, I mean, I've heard stories that people try to take stuff from them and then they end up sending them back. Like I was talking to Dina today. Shout out to Dina if she's listening. And she had something from a Civil War thing that, like a stick or something she took, and then she ended up getting rid of it later, burning it. But we were talking about, like, a lot of people will end up taking something, I guess, like some kind of, like, I don't know, not an arrowhead, a musket or something, I don't know. But then they get home and weird stuff happens. You ever heard any stories like that?
I've heard a few people tell stories like that. I actually, when we were shooting at Shiloh for the Ghost of War documentary, I was shooting a shot, because I actually ran the camera on the documentary, and we were shooting a shot across a pretty big area called the Hornet's Nest at Shiloh Battlefield. And when I bend down to get this cool low shot, you know, what would have been basically a POV of a soldier peering over these wooden railings, I felt something kind of poke my knee. And when I looked down, there was a mini, a little, like a bullet from one of the guns from back in the day. So I was like, oh, this is cool, you know, finding a, you know, Civil War bullet on the battlefield, you know, while I'm here shooting the documentary. So I stuck it in my pocket and I took it home. Well, I mean, I have never had anything happen since taking that, you know, home with me. But I have heard, you know, a couple, three people say, you know, that things like this have happened. And there's a pretty infamous story that's detailed in the book. I don't have the book in front of me, so I can't pull it. I wouldn't be able to pull it out anyway, since there's more than 150 battlefields in there. But the story goes, I want to say it was in West Virginia. This family moved back to their house after this battlefield, this battle had taken place. And someone was hired to go out there and put the bodies, pick them all up and then bury them properly. But this person, of course, being sort of a dirtbag, threw them into sort of a mass grave and just said, my work's done. And all these different things started happening on the property. And some say it was because of the mass grave, and the others say it's because the daughters who lived in the home would go on the battlefield and find these, you know, the swords and different pieces of the uniform and the buttons and things, and they were bringing these things home, and so they thought a lot of the activity might have followed, you know, those items. So, yeah, I mean, those stories are around.
That's pretty cool. I've wrote some paranormal books in the past. I'm trying to write horror fiction. I'm trying to do something like Tales from the Crypt or something, and when she told me that, it gave me an idea for, like, a fiction horror story of somebody doing that in, like, a creepy, you know, Confederate soldier ghoul shows up at the house or something. But I'm always curious, all these ghost experiences, I mean, are most of them, I know you talk about a wide assortment of them in the book, but the visual ones, there are a lot that are visual and they're always still dressed in the clothes from that era. That always fascinates me with, you know, that they're still, like, wearing these clothes. And I know there's different theories as to what they are. You know, they could be the actual ghosts. It could be just memories from the area psychically or something. I'm just kind of curious, with the visual experiences, are they always wearing the same time, you know, the clothes from the era? And could you tell us one of your favorite stories or something like that?
Well, on the battlefields particularly, because most of the activity tends to be sort of like of a residual nature, if they actually see soldiers out on these battlefields, they're really the ghosts of soldiers, it does seem like, you know, they're just almost reenacting, like, the moment in time, you know, back in the day, because they're usually in uniform, just like you're describing. Sometimes there's, you know, multiple soldiers, almost like you're looking at a phantom army and they're walking across the field kind of a thing. And even more common than seeing something is hearing something, because the most commonly reported activity from the battlefields is the sound of cannons firing, muskets firing, people, like, you know, screaming like battle cries or yelling in pain, things like that. Those tend to be the most activity, you know, that occurs with that. Probably my favorite story on that was a local story, and I think it had a big impact on me, even when I did the documentary. But there's a story that comes out of Shiloh about a little drummer boy who was marching the Union soldiers into the battlefield of Shiloh and was killed. And people have seen the apparition of this little drummer boy, you know, in full, you know, Union uniform, you know, walking across the road, beating his drum, et cetera. And that story, I think, kind of stuck with me, you know, through the book and the documentary, and sort of reminded me that, you know, it wasn't all just, you know, a lot of kids, you know, signed up, you know, lying about their age and whatnot. And just like in this case, I mean, this was actually, I think this was like about a 10 to 12 year old that, you know, he was just supposed to be there playing the drums, you know, not actually fighting. But when the bullets broke out, he got hit. So there we are.
That's crazy. And then, of course, I see the little kid, like, or hear the drum or something.
Absolutely. Yep. They hear the drums. They can hear the sounds of the army marching. And people have said they've actually seen the ghost of the boy.
Definitely. So did you, that's definitely creepy for sure. Did you, so how did you go about traveling to all these places? Did you drive or you go by plane? I mean, you visited most of these places, right?
I went to all the ones that I could. Believe it or not, we kind of associate the Civil War, you know, with the southern states, with, you know, a handful of the northern states, and even, you know, Missouri, Kentucky kind of, you know, had a lot of bleed over because they were, you know, supposedly an independent state, but they ended up with battles too. But believe it or not, I mean, there's a lot of Civil War forts that go as far as Oregon and Washington, you know, because they were always afraid that another country was going to jump in with one of the sides and, you know, come in from the opposite, you know, side kind of a deal. So a lot of those more remote areas, no, I never went to those, but I went to as many as I could, especially up here in the area of Tennessee, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, the Carolinas, that kind of thing. The ones I couldn't get to, I would typically just sit down and get phone interviews with the park rangers of the individual parks and get the stories that way. A lot of internet research, a lot of talking to other paranormal groups. I mean, you name it. I mean, this is kind of my third haunted locations kind of book, you know, the first one being The Ghost Hunter's Field Guide. And then last year I had a book come out called Haunted Bridges, and you and I talked about that. So this is, you know, this isn't the first time I've had to sit down and research 150 places in one whack.
Definitely. And so I guess, are there any stories, like, historically, what was going on with American Indians during all this? They were still around, right? Well, how do they fit into the Civil War? Like, I'm an idiot sometimes. I know they were there on some level, but what was going on with, like, history-wise with that, with American Indians and stuff?
I'm not totally clear on that myself. I mean, I know that there were different tribes, especially up in the, the upstate New York area and, like, the northern states, that they would actually join the Union Army because it was a great way to, you know, to make some money and be fed and sort of fit in and that sort of thing. I think a lot of the fighting most likely pushed the tribes that were still free, probably just kind of pushed them west, and they avoided the whole thing. Because, you know, all the research and all the talk about these different battles, even when I, you know, because I've always been interested in the Civil War anyway, you just don't run into a lot of stories about, you know, the Native Americans serving for the Confederacy or the Union. You know, and it's typically, you know, right after the Civil War, you know, that the Union Army just sort of rolled right out of taking care of business in the Civil War to almost going right into the Indian Wars of fighting Indians. So,
okay.
I think, honestly, I don't think there was a whole lot of, other than, like I say, some instances in the North, I don't think that Native Americans really wanted to participate in our war. I think they were kind of probably sitting on the sidelines, like, you know, let them, you know, kill each other for a while.
They were probably just so busy trying to survive in the slum reservations they were put in. That was probably enough to keep them busy with that crap episode, I'm sure. But let's turn it over to Jay for a few minutes. I'm still catching my breath from the tech thing. I'm okay, but it messes my OCD. So let's let Jay ask a few questions. Go ahead, Jay.
All right, hey, Rich, let's, we didn't get any questions in about you and your background, so why don't you tell us about you and how you got into the paranormal investigations and what kind of investigations you've done and enjoyed doing?
Well, I probably got into it the same way probably you guys got into it. I mean, back in the day, being young, you know, watching shows on TV like Sightings and Unexplained Mysteries and even like The X-Files to an extent, stuff like that, I mean, I honestly don't remember a time in my life that I wasn't interested, you know, in the paranormal. I mean, and not just ghosts, but, you know, I always found books about, you know, things like Mothman and Bigfoot fascinating and some of the more bizarre UFO cases. And so I've kind of just always been into the paranormal thing. When I got out of the Army, I hooked up with, you know, a good friend of mine in Missouri who's a partner with me in Paranormal Incorporated, but we have a website called Paranormal Incorporated, all spelled out, .com. And it's just kind of like a website where we just started kind of putting down our different kind of ghost adventures that we would go on. And over the years, we as we got more and more into it, we hit the big places like the Crescent Hotel around here, Limp Mansion, places like that. We just started building relationships and trying our best to be objective and, you know, use as much scientific method as possible and attending different conferences and things and, you know, speaking out. We kind of thought, you know, something was awry and we should do things a little differently or a little better. And eventually it led to me finally starting to sort of write about everything. And it kind of culminated with doing a ghost hunting for beginners book for Llewellyn. So I honestly just don't remember a time that I wasn't into it. But as far as seeing our investigations and stuff, there's a crap ton on our website. I mean, all the way with EVPs, videos, photos, you name it.
Excellent. Yeah, was one of the things I was going to want to get into at some point was the EVPs. And Jeff asked some pretty interesting questions about ghost investigations a few minutes ago. But we had some investigators on that they specifically work at the Gettysburg Battle Site, which is about an hour from where I'm at. And I asked them this question, so I'm going to ask it of you. They were able to actually record some EVPs of ghost activity and then go back later on in their investigation and tie names and things that would identify that person on a list of men who were actually at that battle and died. So have you come across any kind of that evidence where you get an EVP of a man telling you his name and then you find his name on a list at that battlefield?
Not at battlefields. We've certainly been to, you know, haunted places. A lot of them being antebellum homes and things like, we go to a place called Magnolia Manor in Bolivar, Tennessee a lot. And it was actually a kind of a headquarters of sorts for General Grant for a bit prior to the Battle of Shiloh. A lot of places like that we have gone to, you know, and gotten EVP answers that seem to be, you know, direct answers to questions, you know, like, you know, how long have you been here? What's your name? That kind of thing.
Yeah.
But a lot of those times we kind of already know, you know, who lived in the house. And so they're kind of just confirming something for us. Battlefields, only thing that really I've ever gotten audio-wise from a battlefield has been cannon fire, things like that. And that actually happened at Fort Pillow here in Tennessee. We went there where there was a famous massacre perpetrated by Nathan Bedford Forrest on a troop, a garrison that was stationed at Fort Pillow. And while we were there, we actually, it wasn't even an EVP. It was actually disembodied sounds, because while we were standing there just sort of surveying the area, you could hear cannons going off, just this little boom, 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 boom in the distance, and little pops of guns. And so we turned on, you know, we had our audio recorders already going, trying to get EVPs there. So we managed to get some really good audio of the guns and cannons going off. And that's actually on the website, I think, Fort Pillow article.
And why do you think that's possible? I mean, I don't understand. I found that interesting when you mentioned that you heard cannons and stuff earlier with Jeff. You know, the EVP's voice, it freaks me out. And I think it's probably the only and sole tangible evidence aside from emotion film photographs that's true evidence. But how does a cannon become a ghostly sound? That just sounds like extremely paranormal to me, to quote a phrase.
Well, honestly, I think that disembodied sounds and EVPs are the same thing.
I can understand how a human can do it with, you know, because we have an electromagnetic brain, but the cannon is a non-living piece of iron. How is its soul being recorded later on at the battlefield hundreds of years later?
Right. What I was saying, I think they're kind of the same thing, is what I think is actually happening is, and I'll get into some various explanations as to why I think that they occur. But what's happening is the sound occurs, they're so low in energy that our ears, you know, the older we get, the worse our hearing becomes. And honestly, those little mics on our audio recorders are so much better than our ears that a lot of the things that we're going, you know, this is an EVP because no one heard it live. Yeah, because it was so low in energy at such a low volume. Yeah, you didn't hear it live, but the audio recorder did pick it up. But when whatever's causing this EVP, and we can get into that in a minute, actually manages to have some more energy, and then the signal is stronger and the volume is louder, suddenly at some point it crosses over to the realm of, oh, now we can hear it. So, I mean, we've been in places where we've gotten some great EVPs, you know, say of a female person talking and laughing, and then all of a sudden we're standing in the room and we hear her laughing in real time, you know, laughing around us, you know, kind of a thing. And so 9 times out of 10, when we hear that disembodied voice, when we go back and listen to the audio, there's probably EVPs preceding it. So it was almost like the ghost was building energy to finally get enough juice to, you know, bring it up to where we could just hear it in real time. Now, the inanimate object thing. Well, I mean, one of the most prevalent theories to that is, you know, that, you know, we're hearing basically an event being repeated in time, and that it isn't an actual ghost, but it's almost like a moment in history captured by the environment. And I think that a lot of the stuff, especially on these battlefields, the cries, the people marching, the guns going off, are just moments full of so much energy, so much violence, that it was captured in the environment and it's just playing back like a record for us over and over again. And that's why we get something like a cannon being a ghostly voice.
And I just came up with an explanation just as before you came up with your answer there. And I agree with you on your answer completely. And I think that's a very extreme possibility. The other thing it may be is the memories from the ghost, the electromagnetic brain, once again, having heard those cannons, maybe we're hearing their memory of those cannons going off, or the instant of their death, perhaps.
That would definitely work, I think, instances where you hear it, and then you go back and you play your audio recorders and things, you're like, oh, there's nothing there. I've had those occur. I mean, I remember we went to a cemetery in Atoka, Tennessee, and we heard this horrible sound that almost sounded like an engine firing up. It was like, brrr, and it was so loud that all of us were looking at each other like, what the heck is that? And then when we went back and listened to the audio recorder, it's nothing there. Not one single nothing.
Wow.
You can hear us clear as day responding to it and going, what is that? What is that horrible sound? And so, you know, that fits kind of what you're saying, where it's almost like your brain is tuning it in like a radio. You know, and everyone's hearing it, but it's not actually there, kind of a thing. So it's all fascinating.
Yeah, if a tree falls in the forest, kind of a deal. But I also like to ask technical questions, and I am into the ghost side of paranormal. I mean, I don't actively go out and investigate it, although the guys in Gettysburg actually invited me up to do an investigation with them. I probably ought to, but anyway, I don't investigate it because it's so intangible. The only really tangible evidence that I really agree with is some of the really great, I mean, there's only probably 100 of them or so, great emotion film photos of ghostly images, and some of them are so crisp that it looks exactly like the person who's dead, who they know who's in the picture. But the EVPs and the pictures, that's about the only substantial evidence that we can get of the ghostly realm. Do you think a technology exists? Will there be a technology that we eventually can record clearly and crisply the other side, get a picture of our loved ones, get an audio recording of someone saying, hey, I'm sorry I died, but I'm okay. Do you think it's possible?
You know, I don't, you know, the answer to that, I think, is more along the lines of when is, you know, mainstream science going to take things like this more seriously? Because
yeah.
I don't think until the subject, you know, and I'm not even going to just isolate ghosts on this, until we think, you know, take, you know, sightings of cryptids and UFOs and things like ghosts and experiences that people are happening every, you know, to people every single day, until those things get sort of taken seriously by the mainstream scientific community, I don't think we're ever going to have better gear, like, you know, that you're getting to. I mean, you know, right now, I mean, we have to drop, you know this, if you want to go buy a nice FLIR camera to see thermal, you know, because, you know, there's some great experiences and data to back up, you know, that maybe thermal energy is the way to see some of these things. Those are expensive cameras, man.
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, they're not bulk producing those things. You go and buy a FLIR, you're dropping a chunk of change, you know, to get that gear. And I think, you know, this is more of like, we got to get science, you know, really getting involved with this. And if you're into physics at all, a lot of the brand new physics people coming into the biz are really starting to look at the idea of a soul and what happens to a soul when it leaves a body and these questions. And it's sort of been theoretically proven and, you know, in physics, which almost anything is, it sort of could be theoretically proven in physics, you know, that it's entirely possible that can be explained by science. And so I'm hopeful that it'll be taken, you know, seriously at some point, and we will start to get cameras that are crafted by real, you know, how cool would it be to have an actual, you know, Canon ghost camera, you know, or Panasonic ghost hunting camera, you know, that we weren't just hacking cameras for, you know, full spectrum and, you know, trying to buy old Sony night shots so we could go out and get something, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, the old trick with the Sony night shots, when they first came out, there was a special RF filter, I think. I don't remember the code for it, but it was an infrared filter you could put on the front of it, and you would be able to see through most clothing.
Yeah, that's why they yanked all of the still cameras, man. They did, like, you know, they had three cameras that came out that actually had the night shot feature on a still camera, and I actually have one of them. And the thing that was so cool about those cameras were, I mean, yeah, you could get the infrared filter, the really dark red filter, put it over the camera, and then you could go shoot infrared daytime photos for that thing. You just, you know, knock back the light with an ND filter, and you could take that camera around in the daytime. You didn't have to wait at night, you know, to turn on the night vision to go using that camera. So, but yeah, that's the reason they actually discontinued that, was because people were using that infrared filter because they could see through, especially blacks, for some reason.
Yeah.
Somebody had a black t-shirt or a black skirt or a pant, and you could
wasn't even there.
It.
Yeah, it wasn't even there. You couldn't even see the outline of it most of the time.
Right.
So I agree with you. I think the technology already exists, to be honest with you. I mean, I think our government has got so far advanced technology that we're easily in the Star Trek realm of, you know, advancedness. But they're holding on to that kind of technology. So, but the hard part is, you mentioned, is getting mainstream science into this. And it's not just ghosts. It's, you know, cryptid creatures. It's UFOs, alien creatures, maybe even paradimensional creatures, extra-dimensional creatures, extra time, you know, extra chronicle from other times, past or future times, that are advanced enough to travel through time. Mainstream science just laughs at us, and they're, until they agree to look at it from a true scientific point of view, and you say some of the younger ones are starting to do that, it's not going to go anywhere. And it's great that we have people like you writing books like this that, you know, at least it's getting, you know, it's still going out into the public's view.
Well, Well, and let's be honest, science has always done this. I mean, these were the same people that, too, that said, you know, the Earth was flat and it was not round. And, you know, and then later, it, you know, the science caught up to it. And then, oh, it is round. Oh, all those things in space, you know, they're not really, you know, different galaxies and planets. And, oh, wait, the technology catches up and science takes it seriously. And suddenly we have a whole universe around us. And so, I mean, to me, it's just another one of those things, you know, the afterlife and ghosts and things of that nature are just, you know, the next place we got to push science to. And, you know, eventually we're going to get that holy grail, you know, evidence stuff that, you know, that no one's going to be able to dispute. And then, you know, and then it's going to be a firestorm, you know, and it's going to be interesting to see what happens when it comes out.
Yeah, it could be explosive to some of the religious wars from the centuries past. It's people comparing science and religion to each other in certain ways and, you know, could cause conflicts. So in researching the book, how many actual places did you go to? Was it like within, what 100 miles of you?
Well, I mean, I have 10 battlefields, you know, that I really concentrated on for the battlefield, you know, section. And I went to 8 of the 10. And then the other two, like I said, I gathered most of the info via other paranormal groups and talking to the parks themselves. The parks themselves are actually better resources of information than we think because, you know, I was always kind of like, you know, like the first time I went to Shiloh, I went up to one of the park rangers and thought, you know, I'm just going to ask him if he knows any ghost stories or if he's seen anything here. And I'm kind of thinking, you know, this guy's going to, he's going to look at me, you know, like I'm crazy and, you know, shoot me down. And, oh man, this guy, you know, he started telling, you know, pointing out all the spots where people have seen things, telling me stories about the park rangers, you know, telling me, you know, you should do this thing that, you know, go over here, you'll hear, you know, guns and things. And, you know, these guys really know what's going on, man. And you'd be surprised how many times these people are willing to speak up and talk about them. I even extend that to, like, you know, going to haunted hotels because so many ghost groups, you know, they pick a haunted place like the Crescent Hotel and they go there and they rent some rooms. And then they kind of do these covert investigations, you know, where they put, you know, some recorders in the room and then they kind of walk the hall snapping pictures and this kind of thing. And, you know, I say, you know what, you should just go right up to the desk. Tell the people what you're into, what you're doing, and you will be surprised sometimes what they will do for you. I mean, I've had places go, oh, you want to go in the basement? Come on down. I'll take you down there, you know, or you want to do this thing, you know, they show you the hot spots and, you know, other things that they've gotten. So, I mean, I always tell ghost groups, man, you know, whether it's a battlefield or a place like the Limp Mansion or Crescent Hotel, let them know why you're there. Tell them what you're doing. You'll be surprised. I mean, a lot of them are very accommodating to it.
And while investigating for this book, was there any one particular story that you just couldn't put in, whether because of space or was just so unbelievable that you didn't think it would go very far in the public's eye?
Well, I don't think I had any cases or stories or places that I didn't put in. But, I mean, a lot of those places, like just, you know, looking at the battlefields, like you live close to Gettysburg. So, I mean, you know how many places around Gettysburg, you know, have their own ghost stories. I mean, you have the battlefield, obviously, with Devil's Den and the Saks Covered Bridge and all that. But, you know, you can go to Gettysburg for 2 weeks and stay at a different haunted B&B or inn almost every single night. You
yeah.
know, go eat at haunted restaurants. Go have a beer at a haunted tavern. Go check out the haunted museum over here, you know. I mean, you know, a lot of the times on some of those places like that, you know, I could blurb them and sort of mention them just to get them all in there so people were aware of them. But because of space constraints, I didn't get to get into a lot of the places in as much detail as I would have liked to got into. So I kind of wish I could have had a little bit more space for that. But, you know, that's just kind of the way it plays out.
Yeah, I'm pretty lucky where I'm at. I'm surrounded by quite a few really close ones, Gettysburg, Antietam. I think there's one in Pennsylvania. Sharpsburg is really close. There was one in, actually, there's a city, I don't know if the city of Rockville was alive during the Civil War, but there's a battle in Rockville where I grew up in Montgomery County, which is about an hour from where I'm at now. And then there's a bunch in Virginia. I think Bull Run is a big one over in Virginia. So within like a 2-hour, 3-hour drive, I could do a couple battlefields a day if I had the gumption to do it.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, I did a chapter, you know, I think it's called like Smaller Skirmishes, where I talk about a lot of the more like little clashes and little small town battles and things like that. But of course, you know, the big criteria for me for the book was, you know, I needed a ghost story. So I ran into tons of really cool, you know, historical stories, you know, this cool little battle over a bridge that drug out for 3 days and has all these cool little stories about it. And, but there's no ghost story. So, you know, there was no sense to put it into the book. So I had a lot of those type of instances occur. But I think, man, I mean, I am quite sure there are still ghost stories floating around out there that I just didn't wrangle up, because, I mean, it does seem like almost every place associated with the Civil War, almost all of them have a story of some sort, you know?
So you're saying there's a book two coming?
I don't think I could fill a book two. Maybe we'll say an addendum for the second issuing of this book.
Or, yeah, for the 10th year anniversary, put in a couple new chapters.
Exactly.
Well, some of the things I find fascinating about the Civil War is the parallels to right now. I mean, could it happen again? Is it about to happen? It kind of seems like it could possibly happen right now, or it's about to on some level. So from a historic point of view, that's why I find it so fascinating, because you can learn from it. And it seems like in America we may be repeating that pattern at some point, just the way everything's headed and everything. So have you always been interested in the Civil War and just had a lot of knowledge about it, or did you learn a lot as you were going with this? I'm sure you picked up a lot of new things from just visiting all the places. But I'm kind of curious, when it comes to the Civil War and parallels to our current reality, what do you think about that as well?
Well, I mean, the current tensions and things going on in the country right now, I mean, we like to argue amongst ourselves about a lot of things, but, you know, when it comes down to the nitty-gritty stuff, I mean, we all take a stand against most wrongs and get along on a more basic, you know, level. So, no, I don't ever foresee us ever having anything even remotely close to that. You know, although I'm quite sure there's probably a lot of militia groups running around this country who'd love to get something going with the government, you know. But I don't really, you know, I kind of stood off on this whole statue thing, because my opinion on that has been, you know, when you have statues of people who died in battle, because I'm also a veteran. You know, I was in the Army for 8 years and 3 combat zones stationed in 1st Infantry Division in Germany. And, you know, I think that a statue should be, you know, especially of a war hero, should be respected. And my opinion has just been, you know, if a statue's standing in the middle of town and people want to complain about it and all this kind of stuff, okay, I'd rather it was moved over to, you know, like, for instance, here in Memphis, we have statues right in the middle of town, you know, that have been sort of protested and stuff like that. My thoughts just been, you know, Shiloh's right down the road. If it's going to move over to Shiloh and get respected versus being in the middle of Memphis and have people talk smack about it, let's move it to Shiloh. Because I would just rather do that, you know, than, you know, have a war hero say disrespected or something. But as far as the Civil War, though, yeah, I've always been interested in it. And I think also it's been exacerbated by living here in Memphis, because I'm surrounded by it, man. I got Shiloh right down the road. I mean, we had the Battle of Memphis. We have Fort Pillow right up the way. The Battle of Stones River was in Murfreesboro. Vicksburg is just south of us in Mississippi. So, I mean, I've just, that's also why I shot the Ghost of War documentary. It's just accessibility.
Do you know much about Mariana? Have you heard of that where I'm at all, or any stories from it at all? Florida?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure you're talking about Mariana, Georgia, right?
No, this is Mariana, Florida.
Right.
Turn the panhandle. It's not 40 or 50 minutes away from Georgia and Alabama.
I can't remember just offhand if I put anything from Mariana or not, but I know I have an index in the back of the book, so here I am. I'm like frantically.
I got it.
I can't remember if I did for that specific town or not.
I read it when I first got it.
No, like all I did in Florida was Fort Pickens, Fort Zachary, and the Battle of Olustee, and that's Gulf Breeze, Key West, and Olustee, respectively.
What about the Gulf Breeze Fort Pickens? Someone just
Fort Pickens.
What were you saying? I'm sorry, you cut out for a second.
Oh, I was just saying, I was making sure that wasn't Joe saying break. Did you say, was that Joe saying break? Or no, no, I don't think we're doing a break. But, anywho, Fort Pickens, Gulf Breeze, Florida. What can you tell us about that? Because I find it interesting because Gulf Breeze is like a crazy UFO situation. Like, there used to be a museum there. I don't know if it's there anymore, but I went through there many years ago, and there was a weird UFO museum called the Gulf Breeze sightings. Like, some crazy everybody went nuts about UFOs down there, I think, like, in the 70s or 60s. Joe could probably tell it better than me, but I have a book about it somewhere. I'm just kind of curious, what's the story on that situation it seems like a hot spot for sure.
Well, I mean, I was about to actually ask you, because you're mentioning, you know, your town there in Florida. Have you heard a ghost story about that spot?
About Mariana? No,
yeah.
Not in particular. I mean, I'm sure there are some, but I don't know one offhand or anything. But I know there's all kinds of weird ghost places here, like every building supposedly haunted. I know ghost hunters were here at the mayor off building. I forget what the place was called, but some big old creepy house, and they did a show there from it. So I know. And then you go down the city and stuff, and they're like, oh, everything's haunted. Every place you go to, there's like weird ghost stories. So I haven't really heard any Civil War ones, but I'm sure if you talk to the right person, there's someone that'll tell you, for no doubt about it.
Well, I can tell you that Fort Pickens has an interesting story, because when Florida was sort of trying to decide, you know, if they wanted to side with the Confederacy or stay with part of the Union and that sort of thing, one of the really quick-thinking Union officers, and I think his name was Lieutenant Slemmer. Yeah, Lieutenant Slemmer. He actually went down to Fort Pickens, which had been abandoned because it was actually used for the War of 1812. And so he went in there and just sort of took the fort over with his garrison and set up Union soldiers in there. And then, knowing he didn't have enough men to sort of man the other neighboring forts, he sent them over and with demolitions and blew up the other forts. So when the Confederate troops came, you know, in from the Gulf and was going to come into Florida, two forts had been destroyed, and this guy and his garrison were basically sitting there with this fort and fought them off successfully. He just kind of like single-handedly held that entire area. So a lot of the activity there are kind of the same residual things we've been talking about. Mostly the sounds of those battles, and shadowy figures have been seen sort of standing on the walls and walking around the grounds and different stories like that.
Dina from our audience is asking about, do you know anything about the battery in Charleston, South Carolina, Battle of Mobile Bay? Or is that two different things she's asking? I think, what about the battery in Charleston, South Carolina? You heard of that?
In Charleston, South Carolina. Yeah, well, I mean, Charleston, South Carolina comes up in there a few different times. Yeah, the Battery Carriage House Inn is really famous there. Do you think that's what they're talking about?
Yeah, I believe that's what they're talking about.
Oh, yeah, well, the Battery Carriage House Inn is a enormously popular B&B/little mini hotel. It's hugely popular with ghost hunters. They have all kinds of different stories that come out of there, apparitions. People who were visiting there, you know, back from the time of the Civil War. And, of course, that area, all of South Carolina, because of Fort Sumter and everything else that was in the area and all the things that was happening, that was really a hot spot through the entire war. So, I mean, but yeah, there's a lot of stories about Savannah, Georgia, Charleston, South Carolina. You can go to either of those towns, and kind of like Gettysburg, you could just spend a whole week checking out all the different ghost stories associated with those places.
Yeah, I lived in Savannah for 13 years. Lots of haunted restaurants. One of my friends runs a walking tour through various places, usually cemeteries, for ghost tour kind of things. And the whole city is just, they're eating it up. It's a great tourism kind of business.
Oh, man, Savannah's awesome, too. I just love how it looks there, man. It's got that old, you know, that old creepy, the hanging Spanish moss and all the spookiness of being, you know, such an old town on the coast is awesome.
It is awesome. The only problem is downtown, some of the brick sidewalks are, they have so much moss on them that you really got to be careful. You can slip and fall and crack your head open.
I mean, you're a ghost.
Yeah.
Yeah. I went to St. Patrick's Day Parade there one year. I don't remember what year it was, but I remember it. It was a mess.
It's
fighting everywhere.
It's Mardi Gras light. It is that big. There's that many people. It's like, you know, the town's like maybe a million people. There's like another 400,000 or 500,000 people that show up just for that weekend.
So when it comes to ghost hunting, Rich, why do you think people do it? Is it a quest for the afterlife? I mean, is it just for like thrill seeking? Because I mean, it's really, I live in here in Alabama. I mean, well, I've lived in Alabama. Now I'm in Florida. I'm originally from Georgia. But I've noticed, like, online and stuff, when you talk to some people or when I've had personals or something in the past, that a lot of people will see that you do the paranormal around here and they'll ditch you. Like, they'll just stop talking to you. Like, you're an old witch and they found you. Like, witch! And they just stop talking. And they're always, you know, extremely Christian, which I grew up in a Christian situation, so I'm not knocking Christians, but it just seems kind of weird, like hypocritical when they act like that, because the Bible's filled with weird paranormal stuff, like the rashes of it, just nonstop weird, completely bizarre. So it's always just interesting how people react to it. A lot of people love it and want to talk about it forever. But there are some people, you just say the word paranormal, they're like, oops, they're jet, they're gone. Do you deal with that a lot from you growing up in the South?
Oh, all the time. I mean, it's, you know, the South is weird because you can go into a state, you know, like Louisiana or Mississippi, and every place is haunted. I mean, to talk to people in town, oh, that old house is haunted. Oh, that, you know, the bridge down the road is haunted. You know, they'll talk about, you know, ghosts and southern ghost stories, you know, till the cows come home. But when you actually start pinning them, you know, to the wall and saying, you know, what do you think about, you know, ghosts and actually going and investigating ghosts, they kind of look at you. Half of them look at you like you're crazy because the idea of going to a place where a ghost is just terrifying to them. And then the other half look at you because to them, it's just stories. It's not something, you know, to be taken seriously and, you know, certainly not, you know, for a grown adult to be trying to go and research and do all this stuff, you know. And a lot of times I soften the blow by also talking about my love of history and folklore because, you know, the really good ghost stories are always wrapped up in good history and good folklore. And so, you know, for me, you know, I like stories. I'm a storyteller. You know, I have aspirations of also writing fiction, fiction and nonfiction. And so, you know, I love a good ghost story, especially when I know it's coming, you know, wrapped up with a good story about history and a battle or something that happened and that kind of thing. And usually when you approach it from that sort of respect, you can get people kind of thinking you're a little less crazy and actually converse with you. And then as far as the religion goes, really the only thing I've noticed doing this for a long time is that, you know, the Catholic Church is really strict about not recognizing the existence of ghosts. So a lot of times when you encounter people in private cases, especially that tend to be Catholic, you run into this conundrum because they don't want to believe there's a ghost there because their church kind of says there aren't ghosts. So what ends up happening is you get into these sort of the infamous Warrens type cases where you have a place that kind of has a ghost story and there's activity happening here. It's clearly a haunting, but because they can't say anything about ghosts, now it has to become this demonic possession kind of a thing. And there's a demon in the house. And, you know, and as soon as that word gets brought out, especially around Catholics, you know, they're suddenly 10 times more terrified. And so I've always, you know, been sort of interested in these Warren cases because that seemed to be sort of their method of operation was to sort of walk into a place. Oh, they got this ghost. Oh, it's haunted. Yep. Nope. Not a ghost. It's a demon. And now everyone freaks out. And then, you know, the press is called in. It blows up into a giant case. And then the next thing you know, the family's mad because they're like, you know, I think it was just a ghost all along. And so they sue the Warrens.
And so you get these things, like the Conjuring case where the family of Barones actually came back and sued him and everything. And so I don't know. I mean, I think the Catholics have a weird dichotomy where, you know, they kind of want to believe in ghosts and they know about ghosts and things, but they can't really admit there's ghosts.
Yeah, one of my big things is I ask them, I go, well, you think you're going to, like when you die, a part of you is going to live on, right? And they're like, yeah. I go, well, when you get ejected, that's going to be pretty paranormal right quick. that's pretty damn paranormal when you're ejected into said paranormal when you die. So how could you not believe in it? I don't understand. That's what you believe as far as you live on. I probably need to work on my approach. I'm probably too blunt. Because I'm someone that's had weird ghost stuff happen. I've had weird UFO stuff. I've seen a wide assortment of beings. That's why I do this. If I would have never seen certain things, I wouldn't be here. I'd be doing something else. But sometimes I wish I was, but I'm stuck with this. But my story was pretty much when I was 17, I tested for cancer. I know I've told the story about a million times, but it's my truth. So that's just how it goes. But anyway, I had testicular cancer. I went through chemo, and during that, I prayed to be a superhero because I was dying. It spread to my stomach and lungs, and I was going through chemo, and I was in the comic books. So I was like, dealing with that was insane. So I prayed to be healed and to be a superhero. Well, a year or so later, my dad died, and I was fine. I'm fine now. I rarely get sick except for a cold or something now. But what happened is a year or so later, my dad died, and I started reading the Bible front to back, Buddhism, Druidism, shamanism, you name it, and started seeking on many levels. And I guess I opened up the doorway at some level in Georgia, and I started to have UFO sightings, ghosts with multiple witnesses. It seemed like strange craft was attracted to every house I moved to. Even had some government type vehicles come out to investigate silent helicopters. And I think something said, okay, you want to be a superhero, we're going to show you a superhero. But so I've seen weird things all my life. That's why I do this. But one of the big things that I've seen is beings of light. And I still see those. Like, I don't have many. I'll see some weird UFO stuff once in a while, but not like in my earlier years. But a few years ago from here, I saw something told me to go outside, and I went outside and turned towards my house, this house here in Mariana, and saw two people made out of light leave my house. Like, they came out of my roof and were leaving my house and flying into the heavens like Superman. I was completely sober. I rarely drank. I wasn't even on weed then. But I saw two beings of light leave my house. So I think it was God showing me that that's what we are. And I've talked to a bunch of different people, from medicine men to, you name it. And I've heard extraterrestrials, angels, us without their bodies. There's a shaman in Peru that said they gather in crowds down there to watch the shining ones in the sky. Which I was like, they do? That's crazy. So I guess I've seen that, so I know. I don't think it's that my answer is the end-all answer to everything. I mean, there's still always more to learn, but I'm still scared of dying. But even though I've seen what we are, to me, on some level. So I just always wonder with ghost hunting, if that's like subconsciously, even if someone's out there just trying to get scared or get thrills or just learn or whatever, if subconsciously or on another level, it's just like a quest for the afterlife. Has it ever been that for you too, or has it just been the investigative side? But is that always like the subconscious is the quest to find out answers?
Well, I think for me, for sure it is, because, I mean, I'm definitely a disenfranchised religious person. I mean, I guess I'm closest to being agnostic than anything. I believe in a God, but, I have no faith in any organized religion. So I think ghosts are an extension of kind of like what we think of as, our soul and the afterlife. And yeah, for sure. I think doing ghost hunting
and having a lot of the experiences I've had in homes where, you know, seeing things and feeling things touch me and hearing voices and getting, you know, things on recorders and all this. I mean, just so many experiences over the years that, I mean, I think it's done a lot, you know, to reassure me that, you know, I don't need organized religion, you know. This is a scientific, you know, natural thing that happens to us. You know, it's part of our body. Our soul is part of our body. What happens to it, that's up for debate. But I think it exists. And I think there's probably a lot of people that are, you know, disenfranchised religious people or just people who want, you know, something to believe in. They just want hope. And this is one outlet for that. But that said, you know, you're absolutely right that there are people who just want to do it for, you know, thrills. I mean, there are people, and, you know, I'm cool with that, too. The thing I've always said to people is, you know, if you're just wanting to go out with your friends, put on some black T-shirts and get some cameras and flashlights and, you know, have some fun looking for some ghosts, cool. You know, go to your haunted hotels, you know, go to your, you know, cool haunted bridges, these kinds of things, and do that. The only piece of advice I've ever given anyone is just don't ever do private cases, because the second that you step up and you say, oh, I want to start answering the call from people to go and investigate ghosts at their homes and things like that, you know, there's a responsibility that comes with that, you know, because those people are going to want answers. You know, you don't just walk in someone's house, you know, and they're having, you know, frightened children and all these kinds of things happening, and they want to know what's going on and what, you know, what they can do about it. And so, I mean, a lot of people get overwhelmed because they go in and they realize, oh, man, we just kind of came in and, you know, did some recordings and took some photos and had some experiences, but we don't really have any good advice to give these people at all, you know, if there is such a thing as any good advice to give them. So I just always tell people, you know, if you realize you just like to do this kind of thing for fun, you know, stick to the public places and that kind of thing, and don't worry about the private stuff, because it ends up being more than you actually want to deal with.
Yeah, I've always found ghosts fascinating, but I've only been to a few haunted places. I've never, like, gone die hard. I guess I've seen so much weird stuff, I don't really need validation, but I still find it fascinating. I mean, there's always, lately I've found it more fascinating than I used to, but I've never, like, gone out all these places and looked. I guess I've always, you know, didn't want anything attaching to me or something, or following me home or possessing me or something. But the last relationship I was in, which ended a month or so ago, a weird situation happened where she was a widow and her dead husband was still there. And I've never had any ghost stuff come up in a relationship or anything ever. So it was kind of my first situation of dealing with something like that. And what it seemed like was he was very angry and negative, and he died in a hot tub taking, you know, pills. And he died at the house, and he never left. And he wanted her, I guess he was waiting for her or trying to get her. I don't know if he was trying, but his whole plan was to get her to be with him. And it was like he didn't even, like, I don't think his sister had a dream, and he didn't know he was dead, and she had to tell him in the dream. But I went there and stayed for a little while, and it was like something crawling at my brain and trying to put negative thoughts in my head. And the relationship ended because she had mean problems, which I think was part of, she had anger problems, which I think was an attachment with him. But it just got to where it ended, and I was like, finally, well, you can just have a ghost. But that was one of my big experiences that I had that was ghostly lately, that it definitely seemed like there was a dead husband dude bothering me from the grave. Like, he's gone now because I guess he got what he wanted. But, and like I said, he can have her. But that was one of my big ghost experiences that I haven't really talked about much on the air at all. But another thing that's terrifying, well, one thing that came up because we had Lonnie Strickler do a remote viewing of that house, and he said he picked up something so angry and evil there, it seemed inhuman, and that the ghost was afraid to go into the light for what he had done because he was afraid he'd be judged. So what I'm wondering is, when you die,
does the light come to you, and then you go through it, and that's how you become the glowy light being, and then you're kind of like a spirit at first. And then what if there's so many people that just don't go into it, and like the dead never leave, so to speak? I just wonder that. I know that comes up in a lot of movies and stuff, going to the light and all that stuff. But it's just, I mean, I've gotten to a point to where I just think about it too much, obsessed with thinking about it, because death is that appointment that we all have, no matter what you think. That appointment's coming for you, and it's something every day. Like, my dog has seizures and stuff, and I just can't, I try to, you know, be loving to him, and I am, but it's like I look at him, and I'm like, well, he's going to go, and when he does, I'm probably going to go nuts. So I wonder about pets and stuff, too. But, I mean, there's just so many questions about it, but I feel like something showed me what we are with the light beings. I think that's a big truth. I just wonder if that's after you go into the light, you become that. So there is stuff with Christianity and other, you know, religion and stuff about beings of light, and shamanism, luminous ones, and all that stuff. I mean, it's something to be thinking about. I don't get how people go all the way through, well, maybe go through life and don't think about it at all, or maybe I envy those people that go through life and don't think about it at all. I'm like, every day I think about it. It's like the appointment that's always there, and some days you're like, well, let's just get it over with. But it's interesting to get into. So what are some plans for your next book?
Well, that's a good question. I've been kind of debating on a couple of different things. I'm thinking, I did one book that was called Devil in the Delta that was about a single case that took place in Mississippi. And I kind of had a good time writing that book. So I'm thinking I'm going to do something like that again, but probably with something more historical. So I've been looking at some different pretty big historical hauntings and poltergeists and that kind of thing. And specifically, I've been looking at what they call the DAG poltergeist that took place in Canada. So I'm thinking maybe about a book about that. Or just, you know, I may just let the publisher say, you know, hit me with something, and I'll be like, oh, here I go.
Nice. Well, if you ever do an afterlife book, let me know. I'll contribute for sure. That could be a project, an afterlife book. Devil in the Delta, that was like a haunted trailer situation or something, like a haunted meth trailer, right?
That's right, yeah.
I don't remember. I know you were on for, I don't know if it was Devil in the Delta or Haunted Bridges. I know you were on one other time, weren't you?
Yeah, I was on with you last year about Haunted Bridges. Okay, I think we did talk briefly about Devil in the Delta, too.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I remember. Just sometimes my memory is a little terrible. But let's get Jay some questions in there, trying to balance it out. Go ahead, Jay.
Let's get back into your book a little bit. So I don't know if we talked about one of your favorite stories or not yet, but what is your favorite story from the book that you can bring to the audience?
Well, I mean, I think I kind of already told it, which is the drummer boy. That's probably my favorite single Civil War story. Now, I mean, there was a lot of stuff, you know, if we want to go beyond this book, the previous book, the Haunted Bridges, was really eye-opening for me because I had never really gotten into a lot of the history and the folk tales and things behind a lot of the bridge stories, because you have sort of your standards, which are kind of like the crybaby bridges. You know, there's a bridge in almost every state of the country that has a crybaby story. You know, you drive over the bridge and they hear the sound of a baby crying, kind of a thing. And you also have bridges in almost every state where people like to do these rituals where they will park their car, put them in neutral, and then they'll see handprints pushing their car, kind of a thing. But then you have some just really cool stories that come out about, you know, certain bridges, you know, like the Bunny Man Bridge story. That's a really good one. There's an actual troll bridge, you know, in Texas that's really got some cool stories about it. But honestly, every time I get on one of these shows and start talking about some of these favorite stories, I can't help but talk about a bridge that's in Ojai, California, close to a state park. And it's known as the Ojai Vampire story. And this particular bridge is just, like I say, it's in Ojai, California. It's a nondescript bridge.
just along one of the interstates, and I detail where it's at in my book, Haunted Bridges. But for going back into the early 1800s, people were sighting what they would describe as these demon dogs in the woods. And then typically at night, these demon dogs would give way to what we basically think of as a vampire. People were complaining that of their children becoming sick and then dying of from lack of blood. People started seeing sightings of this vampire-ish looking, almost Nosferatu-type guy in the area. And hunters would occasionally come across this tomb that was in the woods in the area. And it really became a big story around there. People talking about the Ojai vampire. And that's not enough for this. What's that?
Say the name of it again, please, one time.
The town is Ojai, but it's spelled O-J-A-I, California. And you can kind of put in Ojai, that name, O-J-A-I, and it's vampire. And you can kind of pull some of it up on the net. But a lot of the stuff I dug out of old folklore books from the area of, you know, California, and talking to different paranormal groups in the area, getting some more of the details. But the Ojai vampire is only one entity that goes to this particular bridge, because he actually is the second most thought of person there. The first most thought of person is a being that they call the Char Man, which looks like a full-grown man who's been burnt to a char. And they've seen him walking down the road, standing on the side of the road. And there's been all kinds of different stories as to where this Char Man came from. Some say he died in an automobile accident and he burned up, and now his spirit looks like that. Some say he's an actual, just a creature that lives in the woods. Some have gone so far as to say it's this demonic presence that, you know, is stuck, attached to the land, that appears on certain occasions. But this particular entity, the Char Man, has been seen there just dozens of times. And that's another one you can kind of look up and find some cool stories about. So, I mean, I think easily that particular bridge that's just nondescript, like, you know, an interstate bridge. It doesn't have any, like, overhang portion to it or anything. It's just this bridge going across a small creek outside of Ojai, California, and it has all of these interesting stories about it.
That's awesome. I just got to say, Nosferatu, I have a huge Dracula Nosferatu fetish situation, and like I've seen, you know, of course the old Nosferatu, you know, the silent one, but there was another one that I love by Werner Herzog with Klaus Kinski, and then of course Shadow of the Vampire with William Dafoe and John Malkovich, which is so good, where he's like shooting Nosferatu, and then of course the guy that did The Witch, that crazy horror movie that came out not too long ago with the Black Goat, he's remaking Nosferatu. But I've always had a weird Nosferatu thing. I kind of look like Uncle Fester and Nosferatu.
I love Werner Herzog's version of that movie. I mean, I actually have a poster of that in my office. I love it.
Talking about the one with the Klaus Kinski and he's holding the woman. I have a poster too. It's rolled up. I just got not too long ago. I need to find a frame for it. That's so good.
Yeah, the one with Kinski and the Johnny. Yeah.
Yeah, that's so. Man, that movie starts out with mummified babies on the wall.
Real ones.
I mean,
ones. He got rare permission to go into real tombs to get those shots. So that's crazy in itself to know that.
I love it. I need to watch it again, but it's one of those that really, you know, I mean, it sticks with you. It's like a plague watching that movie.
Oh, I love it. I love Nosferatu.
Yeah, me too. I'm looking forward to the remake situation, the new one by that witch guy. I think he can really do some wild stuff. But yeah, I found there's not much about that. There's a little bit about that situation. There's some place called demonicalblogspot.com was telling the story, but not a lot of stuff came up. Is he in one of your books? Is he in Haunted Bridges?
In Haunted Bridges, I actually detail a lot about the Ojai vampire and Char Man.
Okay. I read it. I just got to go back. My memory, like I said, but I'll definitely dig it up again and reread it. But we got medicinal herb down here in Florida, so some brain fried. But yeah, go ahead, Jay. Sorry, the Nosferatu thing, you know,
That's all right. So the covered bridges thing is fascinating. That I've asked other ghost investigators who do buildings and structures if they find certain rooms more tend to be haunted than others. And, you know, the answers are for, like, you know, an insane asylum, it's the, you know, where they were treated usually. If there was one, like, torture room, if you will. In prisons, it's usually execution rooms and like, the hole where they're put in solitary confinement, that kind of thing. So in your investigation in a Civil War forts and so on, what did you find? Where were the hauntings most concentrated inside the structures during the Civil War?
Honestly, with the forts, I mean, if you've gone to any of the bigger places like Pulaski, Fort Mifflin, Fort Delaware.
Yeah.
Yeah, these, I mean, you know that, you know, the casemates, the places where they would hold the prisoners tend to be the big spots, you know. I mean, I've not personally gone to Andersonville, but I've heard similar stories about Andersonville, too. I would say the places, the two places I think that you stand to get, you know, and I hate to term it this, but let's just be honest, it's what it is. Kind of scary activity where kind of scary things happen tend to be anything that's a prison or any place where there was a hospital and a lot of just people in pain, suffering and dying, like in close proximity. So a lot of these, like the Civil War field hospitals, where they would say they would see just stacks of like amputated limbs, you know, outside the window, people all just dying around each other in horrible pain, you know. That's one place, and the other place is for sure these prisons, because the both sides, you know, the South worse than the North, but both sides really suffered logistically in the Civil War. And people forget, you know, of the over 600,000 people who died in the Civil War, a third of it was because of disease. And, you know, when all these people were in these prisons, they were underfed, they were cold, they had crappy clothing, probably no shoes at all because they gave them to soldiers. They hardly were eating, and if somebody got sick in one of those casemates, everyone got sick. So, I mean, you had so much death and misery in these little dungeons, for lack of a better word, that, I mean, they do tend to be the hottest of the hot spots. I mean, Fort Mifflin is just a trip, you know, to go there and go through the casemates and, you know, back into the spooky little areas. And Fort Delaware, too, both of them are just, you know, fantastic for that. But, and I hate using enthusiastic words for that because I know there's so much pain and misery behind it. But, you know, as a ghost hunter, you want to always go somewhere, you know, where you think activity is going to happen. And these tend to be really good places for that, you know. But you got to feel sorry for all these poor souls that pass in these horrible circumstances.
Yeah, and it sounds, I kind of expected that your answer would follow suit with the other investigators, that it seems to fall around certain areas, like the hospital areas in the fort and where prisoners are held. And, you know, in the hospitals you brought up, I didn't mention that one. The places that are the hotspots there are usually the psychiatric areas of the hospital, the maternity wards, believe it or not, and the emergency rooms, where that's where most, you know, the baddest pains and deaths occurred, especially in the emergency room, car accidents and what have you. That's where the most violence is, like you said, and that's probably where I think that's part of the whole spectrum of ghost investigation is, in order to find activity, you got to go to the places where the most violence and pain has occurred.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, like a lot of people would bring up, you know, when I did the Haunted Bridges book, you know, like, why do you think a lot of the, you know, the really old bridges have so many stories? And it's because, you know, for a lot of small towns, the little bridge, and especially if it's one of these little covered bridges, you know, they were usually a place you took everybody from the hangings, you know, and during the Civil War, both sides, you know, had sort of standing orders. If you caught deserters, hang them, you know what I mean? So you have, that's how you have that infamous story of Sex Covered Bridge there in Gettysburg. You know, they caught some spies, they strung them up, you know, right there in the bridge, you know, and that's one of the occurrences, you know, and things that people say they see there at Sachs Bridge. They see what looks like, you know, a series of bodies swinging underneath the eaves of that bridge. So, yeah, I mean, when you have a lot of pain and misery happen in a small area, it just goes to reason that, you know, a lot of that, you know, violence, a lot of that heavy emotion is going to just sort of be trapped in that environment. And I mean, as far as we, you know, we are concerned as ghost hunters, these are our best spots, you know, with our highest probability chance of getting something.
So in your investigations throughout all your books and other, you know, physical investigations you haven't maybe documented, have you ever found any instances where there's ghost activity where a lot of joy and goodness has happened?
Oh, yeah. I mean, sometimes we get bogged down talking about sort of the pain and misery, and I think that definitely comes along with the Civil War. But for sure, I've been to a lot of, you know, places where, you know, they, you know, the owners of the house were almost like, you know, they're a family member. You know, we say, you know, you stay upstairs, we'll stay downstairs, and the ghost sort of respects them and, you know, stays out of their area. Or, you know, they feel like some of the, you know, they'll smell flowers, or sometimes they feel like it even feels like, you know, they get the sensation of almost getting an embrace, or, you know, that the person there is, you know, a kindly spirit. Oh yeah, I ran across those stories, you know, quite a lot. And even sometimes, you know, like I say, when you get into private cases, this is one of the situations that's kind of the hardest to explain sometimes to people. But sometimes people freak themselves out about this stuff. I mean, you take something as innocuous as, say, a door slamming. You know, mm-hmm. If you're sort of predisposed to be afraid of ghosts and you walk into a dark room and the door beside you slams shut on its own, your brain's going to go, oh, this ghost hates me. It's trying to scare the crap out of me. It's mean. It's awful. It's a mean ghost. But another person could walk into that room and see the door slam and be like, the ghost wants me to pay attention to him or her, you know? It wants mm-hmm. attention. Let us know that the ghost is here. And it's totally a benevolent action, you know? So a lot of the times, the actions, you know, are, you know, possibly a lot more benevolent than we think they are, because we just kind of, you know, have a natural fear for, you know, the unknown, and ghosts included.
And why do you think the difference is? What causes the good to stick around? Are they protecting an area, or is it the same with others that they just don't know that they've passed and they haven't figured out they need to cross on?
Well, I mean, I think it's all the above. I mean, you know, I don't have any answers as far as why some stick around and some don't, but it does seem to be, you know, a case where it does seem like some people just love life to the point that they just, it's almost like they will themselves to stick around, whether it's because they love the people who are there, or they love the property, or they've just always lived there and they don't want to ever leave. It just almost seems to be a byproduct of just sheer force of will. But people, you know, we walk through life and we run into good people and we run into bad people. And sometimes they're good people, but they're just in a bad mood all the time, you know, and whatever type of person a person is, I mean, when, you know, just because they're dead doesn't mean they suddenly, you know, grow a halo or they, you know, they turn into like the next demonic entity. They tend to be, you know, exactly who they were in life, you know, so an angry person becomes an angry spirit, you know, a person who loved living in the home and puttering around all day becomes a ghost who loves the home and wants to putter around all day. So I think there's less mystery there than we even put to it. I think it's just an extension of, you know, what they did when they were alive and what they were like.
And on the unfinished business kind of thing, which is one of the explanations for many of the spirits hanging around, is it's unfinished business.
Oh, well, yeah. And I also think that some
Go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, well, I was going to say, and I also just think some are not necessarily there because they want to be there, that the environmental conditions and whatnot are just, you know, perfect enough to just sort of kind of trap them there. And sometimes that results in kind of a residual effect, and sometimes it results where things just seem to be environmentally correct to just sort of be like a living battery for ghosts. And it kind of just holds them there, you know. Another reason why bridges become popular haunted spots, because of the running water, there tends to be bedrock kind of in the area around a lot of bridges and the bridges themselves. They just end up being just a great place for a ghost, you know? So I think there's a lot of reasons. I don't think there's any one reason. I think there's a lot of different reasons we end up in these situations.
It's up to the individual.
Hey, I was going to say, like, I've heard these stories about where people don't know they're dead. How do you do that? There's no pizza. There's no PlayStation. There's no weed. I'm going to know I'm dead. I don't understand how you don't know you're dead. But I would think you wouldn't be able to do stuff, like unless it's a mimic reality of your former life and you can still. I just try to figure out how you could actually die and not know it. So I've heard that a lot.
Well, I mean, come on, denial is a powerful thing. I mean, living and dead. So, I mean, we can have ghosts who are sort of in denial. They don't want to admit they're dead, but they insist they're still in their home. They're still doing their thing, and you're the intruder, you know. But we can also have people, you know, living who's in denial about ghosts. I mean, I've gone to places and investigated, you know, haunted activity, and you have one family lived in the house. They'll say they lived there, say, you know, 3 years. And every night they're hearing these footsteps, people messing with them while they're sleeping. They have heard a voice talk from other rooms. They have all this activity happening. And then you can go to the family that lived there just before them, and they'll be like, you know, I lived there 15 years and I never saw or heard a thing. You know, and you know that they're exactly the kind of people that, you know, if they woke up and heard footsteps in the hall, they'd be like, man, it's the house settling. You know, if you heard a voice, oh, somebody outside talking. I just heard something like that. You know, denial is a powerful thing, you know, and, you know, living or dead. So I kind of chalk it up to that.
Yeah, you got that right about denial. That's heavy right now in our country. I don't know how you feel about the political situation, but I was for Bernie, and what I see right now going on is like a Twilight Zone insane 2-hour episode.
Well, I love me for Bernie. Bernie's a good guy.
Definitely. So just curious, what do you think about Trump?
What's that?
So just, I said, just curious, what do you think about the Trump situation?
Oh, well, I mean, isn't the writing on the wall? I mean, I think his days are numbered.
You joked
about denial. I mean, I think at this point we would have to be in some kind of severe state of denial to think there isn't something going on there. So, yeah, I mean, the writing's on the wall. I think we're going to see that that man escorted out. It'll be interesting to see. I'm actually at this point, I think a lot of people are more interested to just wonder what's next, you know. Maybe this would be a great wake-up call for both parties to sort of clean their act up and realize in this day and age, you know, it's – you know, you need to be a little bit more up and up that we're paying more attention to this stuff. And, you know, hopefully we can get out of this whole mess with a few positives, you know?
Yeah, I don't belong to any party right now. But I was, my mother was Democrat, so that's what I used to be. And my dad was Republican, but I don't belong to any now, and it feels a lot better. But I mean, it just seems like both are absolute corrupt. And now the right's so corrupt, they just don't even care. They just do it. They just don't care. They're just doing it right in front of us. Like, everything they do seems like it's to kill us or to make us our life worse when it comes to being, you know, money and stuff. So I just don't, I have trouble understanding how people, like, there are people that think they're heroes and cheer everything they do while they're killing them. It's denial. And then the Roy Moore thing, that's just completely insane that's going on in Alabama. That's just the craziest. Like, it's just a circus. My problem with the Democrats is the Bernie situation, and they're just so weak. And so many of them are just so sold out just as much as the right is, you know. So they're just a little more smoother and more, they're more smoother with it than the right. But I'm fed up with it all. I don't know what's going to happen, but it seems kind of, I've never, you know, I mean, there are days with this situation, you feel scared for your life, and that's not something I'm used to feeling with the president. I didn't feel that with Obama, and yeah, he had his problems, of course. There are things with his marijuana stuff that really annoyed me. He probably could have let a lot of people out, but, I mean, it's just crazy right now. I mean, it really seems like we're on the verge of Ragnarok. It really does. And I don't know. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, I think the right really, I mean, this is the thing where Republicans, you know, need to go back and figure themselves out, because I think they know what's going on, you know, and they got to sort of change themselves and change what's going on in their party. And you do see people doing it. I mean, like, you see this whole thing in Alabama, you know, you had, who was it, Senator Flake or someone? He's GOP, but he wrote a check for sort of the Democrat candidate in Alabama because he refuses to support, you know, more. So, and you got, what, Corker from my home state here in Tennessee, who's been, you know, speaking out against a lot of this stuff. You know, he was the sole a Republican vote that did not go for the tax thing. So I think, you know, it's there. They just got to, you know, be braver and do, you know, like, we got to get the money out of the government. Stop this lobbying crap. Let's stop letting people get paid by special interest groups. I mean, until we fix that, and, you know, fix the money thing, you know, people are going to be corrupt. And that's just the way it goes.
Definitely. And then with Trump, it just seems like his whole thing is to divide everybody. I mean, that it almost seems like, I'm naturally paranoid, but it almost seems like he's setting us up to be invaded by Putin or something. Like, he's just divide, 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 so we're just weak and an absolute mess. And he's ruining all our connections with our allies. Like, they don't like us. They just, Germany just announced that, you know, some big thing against us. It's like, everything he does, it's like, seems like it's making, weakening us on some level. It's like he's getting us ready. He's unsold us for a dollar a piece. Pootie. I don't know. I know it sounds paranoid, but you wonder it. You know? It might have already,
yeah,
you know, made it.
We definitely got nowhere to go but up right now.
I hope so. And then, of course, you got 2020 is going to be Oprah versus The Rock versus Trump.
Well, I don't think, I actually think that the Republican Party is smart enough to not even try to put him back up again.
Yeah,
I'm actually, there's been a lot of conjecture here in Tennessee. I don't know if it's bled out to other states, but a lot of people believe because Corker is actually, you know, he's basically retired from the Senate, and he's been sort of the leading GOP guy, kind of like calling Trump out and not voting for the stuff and saying he can't be racist, can't do this, can't do that. A lot of people believe Corker is probably going to take him on for the next Republican candidate kind of thing.
I'm wondering if he's going to resign, like Nixon situation or something like that's going to happen.
Sure.
Who knows? Hopefully it gets better. It's definitely the craziest I've ever seen it, and I've been here since 1974 representing, and I ain't never seen it this crazy, but I'm sure it's been crazy before, but I never really used to pay attention to it until the last few elections. I just didn't care, but now, like, I'm obsessed with it, and it's, like, stressful keeping up with it. That's the key. But and then I've wondered if Trump will gooch the Antichrist, the harbinger of the apocalypse, that guy, something going on. There's some guy I saw, some country dude that I guess, I don't know who he was, but he's holding a sign that said about Trump. He goes, "That boy ain't right." And it's like this country guy just holding the sign, "That boy ain't right."
Oh, man, if you ever want to have some fun, look up the liberal redneck on YouTube. It is hilarious.
Talking about a liberal redneck manifesto?
Yeah.
So
there's a guy, he does a podcast or something on YouTube. It's called the Liberal Redneck. He's a comedian, and it's hilarious.
His name's, I think he's been on Bill Maher, and he has a book, but there's two. There's some liberal redneck Joe, and there's the liberal redneck, his name's Trey or something like that. I know who you're talking about for sure.
Yeah.
But, I had someone tell me, a guy, Jeffrey Stillman, who's been on a lot of shows, and he's an exorcist, and he said that right now, because of the situation with Trump and everything, there are a lot of negative spirits are here who are feeding off of it and would love for some kind of war, you know, situation so they could feed off that energy, and they're like just gathered around hoping like something crazy happens. Like, I'm still trying to understand the Jerusalem situation, like about the Capitol and all that, but I know whatever he just did, like, I don't understand all of it, but I know, you know, the details, you know, as far as he just made that statement about Jerusalem, but they're going crazy over there right now after he said that. It's like, like, all hell's breaking loose. People are going nuts now because of that. And I'm still, and then people are saying that they're probably going to reverse it. It's not going to happen. So it's just weird. Like, he just said one little weird thing, and next thing you know, everybody's saying it's Revelation. Like, all the right wing Christians are saying he's like fulfilling prophecy from the Bible now. And that's, I see that every day online and stuff. That's crazy, man. It's definitely crazy as hell. But so how's Tennessee right now? Y'all getting snow and stuff?
It's cold. I mean, it's down like in the 30s and, you know, that area. But no, we're not getting any snow or anything.
Oh, have you ever been to Kingsport, Tennessee?
No, that's on the other side of the state. No, I've never been over
there,
that way.
I lived there once on a mountain, and there was this weird underground military stuff going on, and I saw some of the weirdest UFO stuff there. And I even pulled up Kingsport, Tennessee UFOs on internet, and somebody took a picture of this weird spear of light in their yard. So I was there, and I saw this big craft in the sky and a smaller craft go into it like a docking bay. And I don't know if they have stuff like that now. I guess they do on some level, but it looks like something out of freaking Star Wars or something. But I lived there for a while on a mountain. I was just wondering, because right now in Florida, it's the coldest it's been ever so far this year. It's like 40s during the day, and I'm in a panhandle and raining. It's just gross. But like 4.5 hours here in Alabama, it's 8 inches of snow. So I'm wondering if it's going to come down here. I'll be surprised if it does, because it's never snowed here since I've lived here, or it has, but it never stuck or anything. But let's see what's going on. We got about a few minutes. We usually stop at 5 till. What's your website?
Our website is called Paranormal Incorporated, and so it's all spelled out, paranormalincorporated.com. And they can go there, and there's links for all the different books, and as well as my author page on Llewellyn Publishing. But if they're just interested in the books, they're available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all typical bookstores.
All right. Well, thanks for the blurb situation. That's my first blurb with a big company. Blurbage.
Write your book, Beings of Light, and then let me read it so I can do a blurb for you.
That's so weird that you say that, because that's something that I've been thinking about the light stuff. You said Beings of Light, too. I thought about Luminous One. Something like that, but that's weird that you say that. You give me a creep now. Because I do feel like there's something that wants me to write a book about all that, and I've been trying to, but I'm having discipline trouble. Like, I have books that I did all these written interviews with people on the Examiner a long time ago with Andrew Colvin. He runs New Saucer and Press. He put them all in books. So I have like 5 books filled with me interviewing people, but now it's time to write like my own thing. Like, that's easy to do. Write some questions and have someone answer them and install them in a book. It's not easy per se, but it's writing your own, like, everything's a lot harder. So I'm trying to do it. But I'm also juggling 2 ideas. One is the paranormal book, like you just spoke of, and then the other is I love fiction horror, and I have this idea I'm working on with an artist for a book that's going to be like Tales from the Crypt or something, like in book form, a Twilight Zone. So I'm juggling 2 things. But my big thing is just like discipline. Like, there's just this part of me that doesn't want to do it at all. And then there's a part of me that does. It seems like the other part's winning, but I'm going to do it. Just I'm having discipline trouble. Do you have that when you write? We still got a couple minutes. When you first wrote your first book, did it take a while to finally do it? Did you talk about it for a while? Did you have discipline troubles? Is that something you go through with writing?
Well, I've kind of always been writing. I've been writing since I was a kid. And the actual first book that I wrote was about applying filmmaking techniques to video game production. And it was a technical manual for Focal Press. So after that, I started actually just reaching out to a lot of publishers on different subjects that I was interested in, just trying to get a gig, And then when I kind of had the idea of doing this, the Ghost Hunters Field Guide, I reached out to Llewellyn and they said, yeah, let's do it, based off of the fact that I had already published 1 book, the Cinematic Game Secrets book. So I've just always been writing. I never remember a time that I wasn't writing, so it's very natural to me. I know a lot of people, talk about, how tough it is to get into writing. And there's a lot of discipline involved in keeping, your butt in the seat and actually doing it. But my advice to people is always just, start at the beginning, start writing, and before you know it, you're at the end. And you'll be surprised.
Yeah.
You'll surprise yourself.
You just got to do it. Have you heard any Beings of Light stories? Is that something you've come across before at all?
Just a typical, that's a common, description for ghosts, that you see what almost looks like a glowing white person, standing in a room, or, walking through the hall or whatnot. So, I mean, for sure, there's a lot of different ghost stories where you can, you know, that comes into play. I know far less about, like, stories of, like you say, interdimensional, you know, creatures or UFO-type sightings. But on the ghost realm, for sure, I mean, that's a very common description. I mean, sometimes so much so that, you know, this is why we have the old cliche, they look like a woman in a big white dress. Was it really a white dress, or was she just glowing white, you know? So, yeah. I think that's a pretty common descriptor.
That's what I kind of think we are when we're not in these bodies. We're like an army of light beings, and for some reason we have to come be in these bodies. I'm still trying to figure that part out. It kind of sucks, but hey. Well, man, we appreciate it so much. Thanks for coming on and keeping in the loop on future projects. If you need any blurbage, let me know. I'm blurbing now. Thanks, man.
Thanks for having me on, guys. Anytime.
All right. We enjoyed it. Thanks, Jay. Thanks, everybody, for listening. You're listening to United Public Radio, 107.7 FM, New Orleans. And next week, we're having a weird Christmas show. So there'll be weird Christmas stories like Krampus and Scandinavian elves and stuff. But anyway, we'll see you next Friday. Take care, everybody. Good night. And I guess Joe's still here. You still here, Joe? End it. Waiting for Joe to end it. There's Pal Talk trouble tonight and some weird echo, so.
I didn't get
Mercury
on Pal
Talk. Mercury retrograde problems tonight, for real. For real. But, dog, will you move so I can walk by? We'll just wait until we hear from Joe. I'm sure he'll end it at some point and intervene. But, Graham's been doing art for the book and everything, which he's got some. We're doing a weird Weird West story where it's the West, but there's like actually a Nosferatu and a Skinwalker, so it's going to be like a weird Western with Nosferatu in it.
Oh, cool. Graham Ganson's doing that?
Yeah, Graham Ganson. You know who that is? Graham
yeah, well, we're not friends on Facebook, but I've seen all the artwork he's done for the show.
Yeah, he's doing it. Me and him are working on it. And I'm doing one more. A guy wakes up in suburbia and realizes he's Vlad the Impaler reincarnated. Just really weird stuff. I'm doing the right and he's doing the art. He's helping with some of the ideas and stuff. But he's grown a lot. He's done art for me for a very long time. Are you on my Facebook? I'll have to double check. I think you are. I don't know. I'll have to double check.
I'm on your Facebook, yeah.
Okay. There's so many people on there. There's like 5,000. I always got to like go through and delete people who never talk to me to make room for other people. But I figured you were, but I don't really keep up with it. Like go through it all the time or anything. And I don't really go to other people's walls that much because I always end up getting in some kind of fight about Trump abuse.
Yeah, I'm the same way. If it comes across my news feed, I'll look at it.
A lot of people's stuff don't come on my news feed, too. I don't know why that is. Like, I don't think I've ever seen anything of yours on my news feed. There's something you got to do to make
yeah,
it.
You go to their page, and on the Friends tab, you highlight it, and it'll say See First, and then their stuff will show up on the top of your news feed.
Okay, I need to do that with a lot of people, then, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Joe, are you alive?
Jojo, don't be a hero.
All right, Rich, we appreciate it, man, and keep in touch. Take care.
I think he might be already gone.
Okay. All right, well, thanks, and did everything record okay, Joe, with all that mess?
Yeah, you are.